The appeal of the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection and so on. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Joy Fraser, Governor Diamonds, Helen Clarius.
Good morning, Beth Ann Trinh, Deputy Attorney General, State Department of Energy Department of Environmental Protection.
Good morning, Michael Keller, Record Danzig, Representative Respondent, 716, Running Water.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Mr. Prather, please go ahead.
Mr. Chief Justice, Honorable Justices, may it please the court. Before I begin, I would like to request 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I'll be back, maybe for a little less, but we'll have you back.
Thank you, Your Honor. Before diving into the merits of the appeal that's before this court, I'd first like to clarify a few matters regarding what Clarios is seeking to have this court address at this time. This is, at bottom, an administrative law question about appropriate process. It is not an interrogation of the broad scope of the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection's broad authority to protect the environment, nor is it about the specific details of what happens at a particular property that requires remediation. Stated more simply, it is about what process my client was due and was deprived when the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection rescinded a remediation in progress waiver, specifically when it did so without providing either notice or an opportunity to be heard before that rescission was made. Not only did this rescission occur with no notice or other process, but it was done using partial and inaccurate information at the behest of an interested third party that was engaged in ongoing litigation with Clarios. Now, when Clarios requested an opportunity to be heard and provide further information that could inform this determination about rescinding the remediation in progress waiver, that request was denied, and the appellate division ultimately affirmed that denial and found that there was no property interest in the remediation in progress waiver. Now, with respect to the specific merits of the key question before the court, which is there a property interest in a remediation in progress waiver that would warrant protections under the due process clause? Here, that is certainly the case for at least the two primary reasons. First, remediation in progress waivers confer benefits that create constitutionally protected property interests that require due process of law before they can be taken away. Second, allowing a remediation in progress waiver to be arbitrarily rescinded by the department without due process would fundamentally undermine the goals of the waiver and destabilize commercial property transactions. Now, with respect to that first reason of the remediation in progress waiver creating a property interest, it is well established that, generally speaking, when trying to determine whether a due process claim is meritorious, courts assess whether the liberty or property interest has been interfered with, and then second, whether the procedures attended upon that deprivation are constitutionally sufficient. Here, there is no dispute that Clarios received no notice and no process, so we need not address the constitutional sufficiency of the process. Instead, the crux of the appeal revolves around the determination that the state interfered with a property interest by rescinding that RIP waiver. Now, there's a property interest because of the benefits that are conferred when a remediation in progress waiver is issued. Those benefits include two things. One, the ability to close or complete a transaction without being subject to the requirements of the Industrial Site Recovery Act, and two, a suspension of any similar obligations related to remediation of property under that same statute. Now, the Supreme Court has established that property interests and a benefit are created and their dimensions are defined by the existing rules or understandings that stem from an independent source, such as a state law like the Industrial Site Recovery Act. These rules and understandings in this instance are further underscored by the activities of the department itself and the understandings that it displayed in its engagement with Clarios and in Clarios's own understanding. For example, when the remediation in progress waiver was issued, there was an understanding that there would be no obligation while that waiver was in place to meet the various requirements that ISWR normally requires when there's a property that has contamination that requires remediation. In this situation, that understanding endured for over 15 years. There was not any attempt to require or demand of Clarios that it take any step to address the remediation because there was a party that had already raised its hand and entered into an agreement with the department to complete that remediation. Now, the understanding that Clarios had by completing that process for that transaction was that it had now suspended its obligations to proceed with any remediation of the property. This was undermined when the department, without providing any notice to Clarios as to its reasoning or as to its basis, rescinded that remediation and progress waiver.
Did the understanding that you've just referred to also include the notion that Delphi's ongoing remediation effort would continue?
Yes, Your Honor. And the problem with what occurred here is Delphi assigned that remediation obligation to DeNovo, which is another third party that the department entered into an agreement with through that assignment to continue that remediation. And DeNovo also happens to be the party that Clarios transferred the property to.
You received the waiver based on the understanding that this property was going to be remediated. Did DEP in any way suggest to you that you bore no responsibility if the remediation program fell through?
Not if the remediation program fell through. The understanding was that, assuming that all of the criteria that originally undergirded the issuance of that remediation and progress waiver were in place, then that waiver would suspend any obligations that Clarios had under ISRA. The problem here is that there has been a question raised, because the record doesn't reflect any understanding or determination by the department, that one of those criteria may now be called into question. Clarios had information to provide regarding some of those issues, and rather than provide notice to Clarios that the remediation and progress waiver was being threatened and offer an opportunity to provide information that would address those concerns or otherwise inform the department's decision, the department only received information from an interested third party that was in litigation with Clarios and also a former subsidiary of the party actually responsible for the remediation.
Is there a dispute currently, or was there a dispute at the relevant time that the remediation was no longer being implemented? The money had run out and nobody was remediating the property. Was that in dispute?
There was no dispute that the property at that time was not being remediated. The dispute was regarding whether there were funds to provide for the additional remediation of the property from the other party that was responsible for that.
Wasn't it the case that the trust fund was depleted at that point? There was no money left in the trust?
Yes, the money within the trust fund had been depleted. But
so the money had been depleted and the remediation was no longer ongoing. So at that point, there was no money and the remediation had ceased to continue, which I believe you indicated the understanding was when the RIP waiver was issued, as long as the remediation was ongoing, that suspended Clarios's obligation to remediate. So at the point at which the trust fund was depleted and the remediation was no longer ongoing, it sounds like that was the situation in which Clarios's obligation now was to remediate.
No, Your Honor, not. It's not self-executing that occurs. There's actually a rescission that needs to occur with the remediation and progress waiver. And Clarios's position is
that DEP did.
Correct.
The position is that there should have been process, but.
Correct, because otherwise the party that was responsible for that remediation funding source and for conducting the remediation is able to simply walk away without communicating one way or other to the department that whether it has the ability to further fund that remediation funding source, and then the department will simply look to an innocent party that did not contribute to that contamination and otherwise did not have that responsibility take on the remediation.
But don't you have an obligation, even if let's leave the label of innocent party in the mix, don't you still have an obligation under ISRA for the remediation if those ahead of you fall short?
There, an obligation under ISRA remains as irrespective of the remediation in progress waiver, but that obligation was suspended by that waiver, and that suspension was in force and granted a benefit that Clarios relied upon and acted upon in entering that transaction in the first place.
The suspension went into place because there was ongoing remediation effort. So the question is, what happens to someone lower down the chain, like your client, if that remediation falls through?
Well, first, there would need to be an investigation or determination of who the parties are lower down that chain that Mr. Chief Justice, that you're referencing. In this instance, that includes Clarios, but there's also an immediate party in the chain that has not been determined is unable to fund the remediation source and had been the party responsible for and had raised its hand to fund the remediation source and was in ongoing litigation with Clarios regarding that property.
But where in the statute does it say that? So where in the statute does it say that before the DEP can rescind a waiver, it has to do this investigation as to who's in the wrong and who's in the right and who should have given the money and who didn't give the money? I have read the statute and I don't see anything like that.
That's correct, Your Honor. There is no requirement for an investigation. What Clarios is saying is that by not providing notice or an opportunity for Clarios to respond that had information that could inform that decision and then create a record to address whatever determination the department made, Clarios was deprived of its ability to get any process before that benefit was taken away.
Under the statute, are you at the mercy of the Delphi and DeNovos of the world based on what happened here?
Almost entirely, Your Honor, in the sense that if the Delphi's and DeNovo's of the world, or taking more broadly, any party that enters into an agreement with the department to remediate and then subsequently, for whatever reason, declines to do so, then subsequent purchases of the party are immediately placed into jeopardy of the department rescinding a remediation in progress waiver, but even more so, also potentially subject to liability of other parties at the site through no action of their own, and also based on a decision that was taken without full information of the implications of that decision.
So if you are at their mercy, what would a hearing have accomplished? What would you have presented as evidence? What would the dispute have been?
The dispute would have been the funding of the remediation funding source. There are significant disputes pending in the ongoing litigation separately, and I don't want to venture far outside the record here, regarding that funding source and the ability of DeNovo, which was the party responsible for that funding source, to actually fund the remediation.
The DEP says that before it takes any action against Clarios to actually remediate anything, that Clarios will be entitled to a hearing. So why can't you just present all of that evidence then? The rescission of the waiver doesn't have any independent consequence in that it doesn't actually require Clarios to do anything, as far as I can tell. And the DEP says before they actually require Clarios to do anything, Clarios will be entitled to request an adjudicatory hearing. So all the information that you're providing or that you say should be provided about the trust fund, why can't you just provide it then?
Well, Your Honor, I would slightly disagree with the fact that rescission of the remediation in progress waiver doesn't immediately place obligations on Clarios. With respect to the department will make a determination and issue an administrative order, and that could be challenged at that time. But at that same time, Clarios is now in jeopardy with respect to owners or others at the property, because now they are immediately deemed to be potentially in violation of ISRA. And the statute specifically provides those parties with the ability to either void a transaction entirely or seek penalties associated with now what is ultimately a potential violation of ISRA, even though the factors have not changed.
So you're talking a lot about potentials and jeopardy. So has any of this happened? You're saying that Clarios is in potential danger and this might happen or that might happen. Again, as Justice Wehner Apter noted, the DEP's argument is, listen, at the time that DEP, if and when DEP seeks to enforce Clarios's remediation obligations, you will be entitled to a hearing and process before such obligations are compelled. So how do you respond to that argument?
Well,
because nothing has been compelled at this point, correct?
Nothing has been compelled by the department.
And I know you just made an argument about all the things that might possibly happen that have not happened, correct?
No, those things have happened, Your Honor.
Okay.
There are pending claims against Clarios under the ISRA statute by other parties specifically pointing to this site.
I'm sorry, can you say that one more time?
There's a pending litigation in Federal District Court in New Jersey where there are claims against Clarios under the ISRA statute that were brought by the current property owner specifically related to the remediation of the property.
Yeah, but that would be based only on the rescission, right?
Are you talking about?
Yes. Apologies. To give a little bit of background briefly, the intervener pursued claims against Clarios under the ISRA statute regarding remediation of the property, Federal District Court Judge Wolfson dismissed those claims because the remediation in progress waiver had suspended Clarios's obligations to remediate.
Right. This is the 2020 federal litigation. So this is, again, before the waiver was rescinded.
Correct.
So, okay. So I think what we're asking is, what are you arguing has occurred as a result of the rescission? I understand that I understand that there is a potential, I guess, that they will seek to reopen that since Judge Wolfson dismissed it because nothing had happened yet.
It has been reopened, Your Honor.
Okay.
The complaint was amended and the ISRA claims were revived as a direct result of the remediation in progress waiver being rescinded. And the request to the department to rescind that remediation in progress waiver was made by that party in the litigation specifically because that remediation in progress waiver was putting them at a disadvantage in the litigation that they were proceeding against Clarios. That is not how the protection under ISRA for properties that are being transferred that were industrial properties where remediation was required was intended to operate, because otherwise it does not provide any of those property owners with any kind of predictability about what risks they are being exposed to by virtue of entering into this transaction.
Counselor, that's why you protected yourself. That's why Clarios protected itself by seeking an indemnification agreement and by seeking insurance at the time, because presumably Clarios said, hey, we're potentially on the hook. So in order to protect ourselves from this exact occurrences happening, we're going to seek to be indemnified if this happens, and we're going to seek insurance if this happens. So when you answered the Chief Justice's question before, and you said, we're at the mercy of the de novos of the world, that's not really right, because you protected yourself from being at the mercy by doing what naturally you would do. You sought indemnification and you sought insurance in anticipation that something like this might happen. So you're not at the mercy if you have the ability to and did seek to protect yourself from these very consequences.
Well, no, not quite, Your Honor. With respect to the protection that you describe, that was the intention, but the actions of de novo and effectively not utilizing the funds that were provided to it to remediate the site, whether that's the remediation funding source or the funds that Clarios provided, as well as effectively stepping away and not engaging with the department, because the record that we see only reflects Urban Renewal, the current property owner, engaging with the department, then that undercuts every step that Clarios took to protect itself. And what we're seeking here is before the department takes that step that has cascading impacts on Clarios, that there be an opportunity for Clarios to provide that information that could inform that decision. And if the department makes the same decision, there's at least a complete record for which Clarios can determine whether it needs to challenge or otherwise there be a decision about whether that decision that the department made was appropriate.
But I'd like to address that. You started your argument contending that your client has a property interest in the remediation in progress waiver. And because of that interest, it's entitled to due process. The appellate division relied on Town of Castle Rock for the proposition that a benefit is not a protected entitlement if government officials may grant or deny it in their discretion. Here, the DEP clearly has discretion to rescind the waiver if the remediation is no longer in progress. Could you address the appellate division's reliance on that case, U.S. Supreme Court case, and further elaborate on why you say your client has a property interest in the remediation in progress waiver?
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to the discretion, the statute does not expressly state whether the department has the discretion to rescind the waiver. It only provides for the granting of the waiver. And in doing so, it lists the criteria for obtaining the waiver, and then it states that once those criteria are met and the information provided is accurate, the department shall issue the waiver.
Can I just address that for one minute? It seems that the statutory and regulatory scheme implies that the RIP waiver could be rescinded, and I'm talking about NJAC 7:26B 1.8B. which talks about the issuance of the authorization letter and the fact that it does not relieve your client of its obligation to comply with ISRA if the remediation in progress is no longer in progress. So if I'm correct that the statutory and regulatory scheme implies that there is this discretion, would your client have a property interest?
Yes, because that discretion does not apply to the issuance of that waiver.
What about the rescission of it?
The discretion is limited to the circumstances that are enunciated in the statute, and those are limited. So the statute has a provision that specifically reserves the potential responsibility for the property. Clarios is not claiming that by receiving that remediation of progress waiver that it would never at any point in time again potentially have responsibility for the property. Rather, it's saying that those obligations were suspended, and that suspension is likened to the Atlantic States case, for example, or Morgan Stanley might be more apt, where there was a no further action letter that the department provided and which essentially suspended any obligation to proceed with remediation. And in that case, the department argued that there was no expectation that that no further action letter would remain in force indefinitely, and ultimately said that, and the court rejected that view by essentially finding that by creating a state of repose that all the parties involved understood to be a state of repose was sufficient to create an expectation and a benefit that constituted a property interest. And that state of repose is the exact same circumstance that Clarios found itself in when it received the remediation and progress waiver.
But your use of the word suspension, throughout this argument, you've said that the obligation was suspended, not that the obligation was extinguished, correct?
Correct.
So your use of the word suspension implies that it is not permanent. The word extinguished would be permanent. Suspension is generally temporary, correct?
Correct.
And the statute we've established doesn't say anything about what would allow the suspension to no longer be in effect, what would allow the waiver to be rescinded, correct?
Correct.
So I'm just not clear, what would the hearing even be about? There is no statutory obligation here that the DEP did not meet. There is nothing that you can say that the DEP did that's contrary to the statute. And if anything, the regulations support their decision. So what would actually be adjudicated at the hearing if there is nothing to constrain the DEP's discretion in a way that it violated?
Well, to be clear, Justice Apter, Clarios is not claiming that there was a specific hearing that needs to adjudicate all of that, all of those factors. Clarios's position that opportunity to be heard could simply be allowing for Clarios to supplement the information that the department has so that there's a complete record. And if there's a challenge that needs to come later, then there would be a full record to do so. But if there was an adjudicatory
process
hearing,
when notice and an opportunity to be heard is generally the idea of an opportunity to be heard is not just that you're submitting information and then the government can do whatever they want with it because they act with complete discretion. Generally, if the government can act with complete discretion, then you don't have a property interest in whatever the item that you're claiming is. So I'm not clear again, like, what are you requesting?
So the dispute that would be adjudicated is the underlying basis for the rescission of that waiver.
But again, because there's no statute or regulations that says anything about rescission of a waiver, what exactly would you be adjudicating? What could you argue that the DEP violated?
That their decision was arbitrary and capricious because they actually did not have a factual underpinning for the conclusion that it reached. In the letter rescinding the remediation in progress waiver, the department walked through the procedure of issuing that waiver and the remediation, but it then reached a conclusion to say the remediation funding source has been extinguished, therefore we are rescinding that remediation in progress waiver. But it did not provide any information that Clarios could otherwise evaluate or respond to that led it to the determination that it's extinguished and the party responsible has no ability to replenish that. Instead, it looked directly to Clarios immediately and rescinded the waiver to essentially put Clarios in the position of having to potentially fund that remediation, but also—
And you agree the statute and the regs don't say anything about replenishment or what the DEP has to consider before it rescinds or whether the person can replenish or not, correct?
Correct.
So it sounds like you want a hearing to, I guess, have a better understanding of de novo's ability to fund the trust. It sounds like that's what your position is, that DEP was arbitrary and capricious for believing de novo when de novo indicated that they could not, I guess they were insolvent, they could not replenish the fund and had no means to do so. So it sounds like that's what Clarios is really challenging, the fact that they're that de novo should be replenishing this fund, or the manner in which de novo spent the money to begin with.
Not quite, Your Honor, in the sense that it was not de novo that was communicating to DEP that it had no ability to fund or any other status of the remediation. It was the current owner that, again, as I said, is an affiliate, a prior former subsidiary of DeNovo, and there was another third party.
So the current owner is communicating that DeNovo did not fund the trust and could not fund the trust, and that's where your issue lies, don't believe that that is accurate.
Well, it's not just a belief. Claros had information that it could provide that brought that into question, and there was no opportunity to present that information. In its letter requesting an opportunity for a hearing to address the rescission of the remediation and progress waiver, Claros laid out several factors that suggested that there was significant problems with the conclusion that the department reached and had not provided Claros any information supporting that conclusion. So the hearing or the opportunity to be heard was so that Claros could supply information that would inform that decision. If the department still moved forward with rescinding that remediation and progress waiver, there would still at the very least be a complete record of information that everyone understood that then Claros could challenge the underlying understanding and whether that was arbitrary or capricious. Where we stand now and the problem with deeming the remediation and progress waiver not to provide a property interest is that it puts at risk other property owners who would similarly enter into these transactions and make the efforts as the justice referenced regarding trying to protect itself from those responsibilities that it did not create for itself by creating an escrow, paying money, getting insurance, all of those things. The fundamental underlying transaction gets brought into question immediately when that remediation and progress waiver goes away.
Of course they created those obligations for themselves because they sought the waiver. And in seeking the waiver, they accepted the fact that, I mean, think about the semantic irony of your argument. It's a remediation in progress waiver. It's not a remediation waiver. It's a remediation in progress waiver. The progress has stopped. The waiver is if there is remediation that is in progress. There is no longer remediation happening. So your waiver is no longer valid. And that's an issue that is between Urban Renewal and between DEP or DeNovo and between DEP. And you're saying, well, wait a minute, hold on. We have information. But the fact that you may have information doesn't mean that just because it has a downstream impact on you, doesn't mean that you're necessarily a direct party to that dispute that resolution that may exist between DEP and DeNovo or Urban Renewal.
But how does it follow that Claros is not a party to that dispute when it is the party that is being looked to address responsibility for the property that is presently owned by Urban Renewal or the New Jersey and is managed by the Department of Environmental Protection?
Because again, nothing has actually happened against Claros yet. And when the DEP does take action against Claros, they say you'll be entitled to a hearing beforehand.
And that will address vis-a-vis Claros and the department the potential issues associated with rescinding that remediation and progress waiver, but it ignores the other jeopardy that it places Claros under through the removal of that benefit of receiving that remediation and progress waiver.
What was that jeopardy again? Because the transaction did happen in 2011, correct?
Correct.
Are you saying that that has been rescinded?
It has not. It could be under the ISRA statute that if there is a finding or a belief that the underlying transaction that was the subject of that remediation and progress waiver is now no longer in effect, or there was a violation of ISRA, which that violation is effectively deemed potentially in place once that rescission is taken away, then the party that received that waiver is technically potentially able to be deemed liable under ISRA. And that liability does not just extend to the Department of Environmental Protection.
Where do we find that in the statute?
That
a transaction can be undone 13 years later.
There's no time limitation placed on it, but it's in the statute at 13(1)(k)(13). And it specifically allows a party to a transaction, transferee to void a sale or transfer if there is a violation of the requirements of ISRA. That's a separate determination, that's a separate action against that party beyond what may be engaged between the Department of Environmental Protection and Claros. And that is what is the broader concern about rescinding that waiver without there being at the very least an opportunity to be heard and notice to prepare for that potential eventuality.
But if the DEP sought to undo the transaction, you'd have a much better argument, wouldn't you? You had a right to hearing for that. I mean, you'd be in sort of gum world then, right? Not that I like to cite unpublished decisions, but you'd be in that world where the analysis hinged upon the fact that there was a transaction that may or may not go forward. So you'd have a very, very different argument about the right to a hearing if they were to seek to do that than if they were to seek to take action vis-a-vis de novo or urban renewal that may have a downstream impact on you.
Well, the concern is not the department undoing the transaction, it's the party to the agreement undoing the transaction. And so that remains whether the department decides to question the transaction or not. And so that, again, is a downstream effect. But with respect to
So in this case, what party are you arguing would be looking to undo the transaction as a result of an ISRA violation? De novo? De novo that assumed the responsibility to remediate from Delphi?
No, that is a broader question about how this could potentially play out. We're in a perverse circumstance here where basically, you typically in these scenarios, the owner of the property that is seeking to sell it enters into an agreement to remediate the property so that it is allowed to sell that property.
But here you already Delphi, sold it, correct? Many years ago.
Correct. Delphi was the entity that had the obligation to remediate the property. It assigned that obligation to De Novo, declared bankruptcy, and wound up various other things. De Novo acquired the property after it had already been assigned the responsibility for remediation by Delphi from Clarios.
Right.
So the voiding is not that De Novo would look to void the transaction. It's that now Clarios is questioning the—
You, Clarios, would look to void the transaction.
Potentially, but the problem with that is we're over 15 years.
You would void your 2011 sale of the property?
Well, at this point, the question is now being raised whether Clarios got the benefit of the agreement that it entered into when it sold the property. If the party that acquired the property and also agreed to remediate now is suddenly undercapitalized and not able to pay, even though it received—
The benefit was that Clarios could sell the property without having to do anything. And Clarios did not have to do anything for many, many years while the remediation was in progress.
Correct.
So there was no surprise. I mean, again, it's just hard to understand this argument because there was no surprise here. There was insurance. You understood that there might be a scenario where this remediation progress could be rescinded.
The surprise is the means by which Clarios was being placed in responsibility for remediating that property. That was not in anticipation at the time of that transaction. That was not the expectation or understanding of Clarios as a department 15
years ago, your understanding was that if this was ever going to be rescinded, the DEP would send you notice and you would have a hearing, even though none of that process shows up anywhere in the regulations or the statute.
But it shows up in the record, in the communications that the department had with Urban Renewal regarding this property. I believe it's 17A, within the appendix, Clarios's appendix to its brief with the appellate division, where the department indicated that it was preparing a notice of intent to revoke the remediation in progress waiver, which reflects that at some point, the department appeared to understand, consistent with the Atlantic States case and the other case I referenced, that before it would rescind that waiver, there was some obligation to provide notice to Clarios. And again, it's unclear what process would be provided, if any, but we don't know that because we don't know anything regarding the underlying determination that was ultimately made to rescind that remediation in progress waiver.
Sorry, you're not arguing that the department sending a piece of paper creates a property interest, right?
Or an email. No,
it's an email. The property interest was already created by virtue of receiving the remediation in progress waiver.
And which I thought you said that Clarios would be seeking to void the transfer. Which transfer would Clarios be seeking to void?
It what brings into question the transfer that Clarios made to De Novo of the property.
In 2011.
Correct. It would bring that into question.
But why, I don't understand, why would that be litigated in the context of a rescission of an RIP waiver, as opposed to in whatever other lawsuits you separately have where you can go litigate whatever it is that you want against?
It would not be litigated with respect to rescission of the RIP waiver. It's a reflection of the downstream impacts and broader implications of there being a a world where a remediation in progress waiver, whether it's 15 years later or the day after, can be immediately pulled without providing any notice to the party that received it.
But it's not immediately pulled. And in the original letter granting the RIP waiver, there's a warning that DEP reserves the right to enforce any ISHRA violations at the outset. So there was that acknowledgement at the beginning that should there be an ISHRA violation, like an underfunded trust, that they could rescind the waiver.
But the ISRA violation that you're referring to implies that there isn't already a suspension of ISRA obligations on that party. That statement by the department is simply saying that if there is a development down the road that would then require the department to rescind the remediation in progress waiver, Clarios would not be free of enforcement under ISRA. But that requirement was in a state of repose. It was suspended.
But that language that Justice Noriega just read was from the waiver letter. So it's talking about the RIP waiver. So I think you just said that the statement was made without consideration of the fact that Clarios's obligation was suspended, but it was in the suspension letter.
Well,
the RIP letter, waiver letter.
Let me correct that then if it was unclear what I meant there. What I'm saying is that was reserving the ability, basically reflecting that by getting a remediation in progress waiver, your obligations under ISWR are not extinguished. They're not extinguished because there could be a circumstance where the department would believe that it's necessary to rescind that waiver, and that would then mean that Clarios could not simply say, I never have any responsibility at this property again because I got this waiver. Instead, the department has already noted that there's a possibility that that responsibility could still exist. However, by granting that remediation in progress waiver, those obligations were suspended until such time as Clarios argues it was provided with notice and an opportunity to be heard prior to the department making this determination to rescind the RIP waiver.
So what about fresh?
No, go ahead, Chief. No, please.
What's your line of question?
Just why isn't the notice of the RIP waiver rescission sufficient? There was a notice suggesting that it was going to happen in the future after the determination was made. Why was that insufficient?
Just to make sure I understand your question, are you saying that the issuance of the RIP waiver with that language is the notice? Is that what you're...
And the DEP sending a notice of RIP waiver rescission. Why was that insufficient?
Because the action was taken at the time that the notice was provided. What I'm saying is that under the due process clause, the action cannot be taken to deprive Clarios of that property interest prior to providing that notice and an opportunity to be heard. And so by simply notifying Clarios that the remediation in progress waiver has been rescinded undermines the due process that was available, should have been available to Clarios, or that should be available to any property owner who receives a remediation in progress waiver because of both the jeopardy that it places that party in with respect to the department, but also under ISRA now being effectively deemed in violation of the statute as it pertains to any party who would otherwise pursue claims under that statute. And just to take a step back briefly on that point, the statutory provisions and the requirements and the purpose behind that ISRA statute are primarily geared towards encouraging the sale of these properties and putting them to beneficial use by various property owners. That is fundamentally undermined if there is no ability to rely on the mechanisms that are created by that statute and the regulations to protect a party selling a property or otherwise engaging in those transactions to be free from obligations under ISRA, subject to, again, receiving that notice and opportunity to be heard.
So your threshold argument is that you have a protected property interest that was violated here. Tell us what, if any, impact O'Bannon has on the argument. In that case, a nursing home was decertified and the residents came forward because they lost their Medicaid benefits and said, we have a protected property interest here. And the court said no, because this pivots off the conduct of the third party, of the nursing home itself. In our factual scenario, the core actor, or the individual that did not act, was the other owner, not Clarios. Why do you have a protected property interest in light of O'Bannon?
Well, first, O'Bannon is distinct in the sense that the property interest that was claimed in O'Bannon was in relation to action that the agency took to the facility itself, not to the recipients. They actually did not lose the ability to obtain those Medicaid benefits. They just lost the ability to obtain those benefits from that particular facility. So perhaps if there was an action that completely removed all of their Medicaid benefits of any facility, then yes, there may have been some need for them to have due process to protect that. What's happened to Clarios here is that its ability to suspend those obligations under ISRA have been completely wiped away. The department did not take action vis-a-vis DeNovo like the agency did vis-a-vis the facility in O'Bannon. So, yes, okay. So the due process protections or the benefits involved no longer exist for Clarios. The benefits involved in O'Bannon remained. They just could not be used in the specific way that those recipients wanted to use them. Here, the ISRA protection that was in place, meaning the suspension or state of repose, was extinguished once that mediation and progress waiver was rescinded. Extinguishing those benefits should require the ability for that party to receive notice and an opportunity to be heard. The O'Bannon plaintiffs did not lose their benefits. They just lost one way to use those benefits. That's a fundamental difference between the world that Clarios finds itself in without having received any notice, any opportunity to be heard, and now having no ability to take advantage of the benefits that were provided when it received the remediation and progress waiver.
Oh, so these are old sick people in a nursing home. And you're saying to me, well, they could just gotten them and moved. So was it that big a deal for them? Is that really what your answer is?
No, not at all, Your Honor. I'm saying that they have the opportunity, the ability to still take advantage of the Medicaid benefits. It's not so much a question of whether or not that particular facility that got decertified, which they obviously had no role in, affects whether or not they had a property interest. The fact of the matter is that the property interest comes from the benefits, and the benefits still remain. And because the benefits still remain, that's why there was no property interest due process violation by making that change about the certification of the facility.
But Clarios has every opportunity to go after DeNovo through federal litigation and outside of the agency context. Why not pursue remedies there? Wouldn't all of this be better suited there rather than seeking an agency determination in an administrative context?
Well, the agency's already made a determination, and that determination is what is actually imposing itself on any effort that Clarios might make to do it as you described, in the sense that the effort to pursue recourse is now significantly hindered by the agency's action without, again, notice an opportunity to be heard. So if Clarios is...
How is it hindered exactly?
Well, now it's subject to ISRA violations to the extent that it seeks to recover from DeNovo or any other party. That will now either offset or undermine any claim that it would make as to responsibility for remediation of that property. And that was not the case when it had a waiver in place that was suspending its obligations under ISRA. So there's no additional jeopardy with respect to the department or other enforcement.
We've gone a bit over the time. I'm going to let others ask questions. Please, Justice, go ahead.
Just point of clarification in the federal case. I know you're back in. Is the insurance company back in too?
Yes, it remains in.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So we'll have you back for rebuttal. Is there anything you wanted to close with?
Only to briefly emphasize that we spent a lot of time talking about what's going on the ground with Clarios and this property and urban renewal. And this issue of whether there's a property interest is a much broader concern. And that should be contemplated and considered by this court when it's considering whether there is or should be due process protection before a remediation in progress waiver is rescinded. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Ms. Pru.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, and may it please the court. I hope to provide some clarity. This case is not about liability. It's undisputed that the Industrial Site Recovery Act, or ISRA, and its predecessor, Environmental Cleanup Responsibility Act, ECRA, impose strict liability for remediation in polluted industrial site that remains on every owner-operator until that site is fully remediated. But that doesn't mean that every owner-operator actually engages in remediation at the same time. The ISRA liability is triggered when an owner-operator transfers the property or ceases operations, but that may mean that the owner-operator will remediate the property itself, or it may contract with another party to remediate the property, or under certain circumstances, it may apply for a remediation progress waiver. The RIP waiver sensibly allows an outgoing owner to cease operations if someone else is already taking care of the remediation, but it does nothing else. The waiver does not affect a recipient's legal obligation to remediate. That obligation remains intact until the cleanup is complete, even when the recipient is taking a backseat to the remediation. The due process question here is whether Clarios, as an ISRA responsible party, had a property interest in the waiver DEP rescinded in 2022, and it did not. Under ISRA and DEP's implementing regulations, the owner qualifies for the RIP waiver where a remediation is ongoing, there's no new discharge of pollutants, or a remediation funding source is in place, and a remediation funding source is in place. I want to make sure I'm very clear about that. As the appellate division explained, the RIP waiver is a creature of statute and regulations. ISRA and its regulations explicitly state that a RIP waiver authorizes an outgoing owner to cease operations or transfer the property, but that's all they touch. Nothing in these provisions eliminates or suspends the owner's liability to remediate the property, whether expressly or impliedly. Nor does ISRA's legislative history offer any suggestion that the legislature intended the regulations in the statute to do anything more than make it easier for regulated community to transfer contaminated industrial property. Clarios asked this court to read an implied benefit of indefinite suspension of its remediation obligations, but this court may not create statutory language out of whole cloth, especially when the added language would subvert the purpose of ISRA, which is to ensure that these industrial sites are remediated in a timely and efficient manner in order to protect the public health, safety, and environment. Here, Clarios realized the benefit of its RIP waiver in 2007 when it ceased operations, even though the cleanup was not complete. And that's what the legislature and DEP's regulations intended for it to do, to conduct the transaction. As the appellate division determined, once the transaction was completed, the purpose of the waiver had been fulfilled and the waiver ceased to have any further legal benefit. Said another way, the RIP waiver becomes a flag on a file. So in 2022, when DEP rescinded the RIP waiver, Clarios had no property interest in that waiver because it had been 15 years since it had ceased operations. And the waiver's rescission does not implicate due process. Clarios claims that the mere fact that DEP rescinded the waiver proves that the waiver conferred a property interest in not remediating. That misunderstands the relevant statute and regulatory provisions, as well as the practical reality. DEP has seldom had to rescind waivers. When it does so as a first step of enforcement to the ongoing remediation underlying the waiver because it has come out of compliance. DEP's rescission of the waiver does not affirmatively require, as noted, an ISRA liable party to do anything. When the remediation stops, DEP rescinds the defunct waiver for the purpose of letting the ISRA liable parties know that the ongoing remediation is out of compliance and that at some point an administrative order or such is going to be forthcoming. When an ongoing remediation ceases, the department could potentially rescind several waivers that are on a particular site, indicating to several parties that they may be asked to remediate the site and perform their remediation obligations under the statute. These parties can either figure it out amongst themselves who's going to do that remediation, or after a time, the department is going to issue an order. Clarios's timing is wrong. When the department issues that administrative order, that's when Clarios can and should request a hearing on the facts underlying its remediation obligations. Clarios time wrong here, where it is entitled to a hearing, but it's not entitled to a hearing on a RIP waiver rescission. In essence, Clarios claims that it's entitled to a double layer of process, that it would be entitled to a hearing on rescission of the RIP waiver and also entitled to hearing on its remediation obligations. In sum, rescission of the waiver merely provides notice to Clarios of an impending enforcement action due to the initial remediation being out of compliance. And as the appellate division explicitly states, the rescission does not pose any threat to the continuing viability of that sales transaction in 2011. For these reasons, the department respectfully submits that the appellate division correctly held that DEP's rescission of the RIP waiver does not implicate any constitutionally protected property interest in relief from Clarios's remediation obligations. I thank you for your time and I welcome your questions.
Is it your position that there was no ongoing benefit from the waiver?
Once the cessation occurred, that is correct.
Explain that.
So once this, so the waiver itself says that this applies to the cessation transaction. It doesn't even touch the transfer of property. The cessation transaction.
But what are you referring to?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. So in 2007, Clarios stopped operating. That's the cessation of industrial operations. That is what required the waiver. Whenever a industrial owner or operator needs to get out from under, whether it's transfer the property, transfer the operation, sell the business, or stop operating, cease operations, it then has an obligation to remediate.
At what point was there no longer an ongoing benefit, as you understand it?
After the cessation occurred.
In 2007?
2007.
So if there was no ongoing benefit, why did you rescind the waiver?
The department rescinds the RIP waiver as notice. So there's no reason to rescind the RIP waiver while the remediation is occurring at the same time. They run concurrently. The RIP waiver stays out there, and the department will rescind that RIP waiver once the remediation stops by that third party in order to let the waiver holders know, because again, there can be multiple waiver holders, know that the remediation has ceased and that they're going to be called to task. It's entirely up to the waiver holder to keep a finger on the pulse of that remediation, because it's their remediation liability that continues until the site is issued a final remediation document.
I thought the benefit was, in addition to the cessation of operations, the right to no longer be held to the ISRA obligations while the remediation is in progress. So the benefit is beyond simply the cessation of operations. Am I right?
We would argue that the benefit of the transaction is the full benefit. Now, where a party doesn't necessarily have to enter into a remediation certification or a remedial action work plan, that's by virtue of the fact that the remediation is ongoing. ISRA doesn't require duplicate compliance. So we wouldn't ask a part if the remediation is already ongoing. So it's by virtue of the remediation occurring, not necessarily the RIP waiver. The two have to live in the same world for them to exist. But a remediation can be ongoing, and a party could not necessarily apply for a RIP waiver. There may be other avenues. RIP waiver is just one of them. But under those avenues as well, they would not necessarily have to get a remediation certificate, get a remedial action work plan, establish their RFS. Under ECRA, and forgive me if I'm talking too much, but under ECRA, parties were obligated to duplicate those efforts. There would need to be several RFS. So the waiver created a kind of parachute of not having to establish a second RFS, of not having to hire, and after Sarah, a second LSRP.
Rescinded this waiver in 2022.
Correct.
Had the remediation been in progress at that point in time, could you have rescinded the waiver then?
If the remediation was in progress at the time, but the RFS was underfunded, yes. We could have rescinded that waiver.
Would you have rescinded it if neither of those conditions were in place?
We wouldn't have.
Could you have? Because you've argued there's no benefit to this waiver beyond 2007, which seems inconsistent with the point that you're making to us, that it kicks in when there is a failure either for the trust fund to be funded or the remediation to cease.
The answer to the question of could we have, yes. Would we have, no. Again, we use the waiver as notice. Rescission of the waiver is notice. Could we have?
What would the basis for rescission of a waiver, if remediation was in progress and the trust fund was fully funded, have been?
There would be no basis to do so. I'm referring to whether or not a benefit that was conferred was exhausted. The benefit that was conferred when the waiver was issued in 2007 was exhausted once the cessation took place.
But that was at the same, so that's why I'm having trouble understanding that. So Clarios obtained the RIP waiver in 2007 when they sought to sell the property, at the same time they received the RIP waiver, the benefit ceased?
No,
I'm sorry. But yeah, so if you can explain.
They get an authorization. That letter is the authorization. And then they can cease operations without violating ISRA. And that's the application of the authorization. That that's the, under the regs, that's the 1.8 that allows you to apply the authorization to the transaction. And once they do that, they are effectively, they've ceased operations, they've utilized the benefit of the waiver.
What would have been the impact then if you had rescinded the waiver in 2007?
Prior to the cessation of operations?
At the time of the cessation of operations.
After.
Right?
Right.
After the transaction.
You've ceased and the next day you're rescinding.
There would be no legal effect. Once the operations had ceased, there would be no legal effect. The site, if the operations had ceased in under a valid waiver, then they've conducted a legal ISRA transaction. They've successfully ceased operations under ISRA.
So your point is, this waiver could have been rescinded at any point in the 15-year period from 2007 to 2022, and no one should read anything into the fact that you took it away in 2022 or its impact at that point on Clarios.
I think it's more accurate to say that the department could have enforced remediation at any point, whether or not it rescinded the waiver. And so rescission of the waiver, we use as notice. The department uses as notice. I keep saying we. But we do not, the department does not have to rescind the waiver in order to ask the party, the responsible parties, to remediate. So rescission of the waiver is effectively the department's notice that we are going to ask you to remediate.
Sorry, so you're saying even when a waiver is in place and has not been rescinded, you can still tell the party that has the waiver that they have to go ahead and remediate?
That is correct.
But you could give the notice even without the rescission, right?
That is also correct.
Are you relying on O'Bannon?
For the proposition that we could not rescind the waiver and still enforce?
No, for the proposition that there's no property interest when benefit is provided indirectly.
We may rely on O'Bannon for that. We also may rely on Roth for this fact that the statutes and the regulations never confer the benefit that they are relying on
The reason why I asked about O'Bannon is if the benefit ended after the cessation occurred, the benefit is not being provided indirectly. They received it directly, and therefore Bannon would be inapplicable. So I'm a little unclear.
But again, the department argues that the rescission and progress remediation progress waiver doesn't confer the benefit of not having to remediate. The ongoing remediation is what confers the benefit of not having to remediate if we're going to call it a benefit at all.
But a party only gets the RIP waiver if there is an ongoing remediation taking place. So a party would never receive a RIP waiver if there was not an ongoing remediation going on.
That's correct.
I'm still confused on the timing. So in 2007, Clarios decides to cease operations. Clarios gets the RIP waiver in 2007 and ceases operations. But at the moment that happens, the benefit of not having to remediate because Delphi was already remediating ceased. I don't understand the timing with regard to your argument and the benefit. Because it doesn't seem like it seems like it all happened at the same time.
And that is because Clarios has continually kind of scooped this benefit in, this implied benefit of not having to remediate into the language of the waiver. The waiver just allows for the transaction or the cessation.
Can I understand, just to clarify a point, based on something you said earlier in your opening about this being a flag to the file, is it your position that the RIP waiver is essentially like a file tickler that you use to determine what other parties could be liable in the future? So you don't rescind them for that reason, to allow them to serve as a reminder. So the reason that it could be rescinded after the transfer is done in 2007 is because it could be done then, or it could be done in 15 years when the remediation stops. Is that essentially the purpose of the RIP waiver for the DEP?
Once the waiver has extinguished the benefit, it remains with the file to notify to the department that when remediation stops, it's going to all the responsible parties. One of the responsible parties or several of the responsible parties may have a waiver in place that is essentially dead on the vine. And then the department notices those parties because where a party has a waiver, they are not remediating. They may not be staying on top of the remediation. They may not be staying in touch with the remediating party who's doing the remediation. So it may be when we rescind the RIP waiver, that parties, and it should not be, we argue, the parties first notice that the remediation is no longer in progress. And then these parties hopefully have an opportunity to confer with one another and say, hey, we're all strictly liable for this site. Where are we at? How can we get this done? And they may contract amongst themselves to get that remediation undergoing, but each party maintains their liability until the final remediation document is issued.
If it's not the first notice, what does serve as the first notice? Is it something that they should just be unilaterally keeping up on their own? Because you said it's not their first notice, or should not be their first notice.
It should not be their first notice. A party should know what's going on with the remediation that they're liable for.
Whether they've owned it for 15 years and have stepped away and have moved on, they should still be.
Arguably, until that final remediation document is issued, yes. Especially if you have financial skin in the game.
Can I go back to Justice Pierre-Louis' question about timing? And maybe I'm mistaken. I was under the impression that the appellate division held that the benefit was extinguished in 2011 at the time of the transaction, and not at 2007 at the time that operations were ceased and they received the waiver. Which one is it?
It's 2007, Your Honor. So the waiver applied to the 2007 cessation of operations. The transaction that occurred, the 2011 transaction, didn't occur subject to ISRA. So speaking to Mr. Prather's point, the transaction is not an issue because the RIP waiver was rescinded.
So if would Mr. Prather's argument be any different or stronger if DEP sought to rescind the waiver in 2010 or at some point in 11 prior to the transaction with DeNovo going forward? So if the rescission of the waiver had gotten in the way of the transaction with DeNovo, would that have changed DEP's argument in the same way that, if I remember correctly, in Gum, that the action got in the way of a transaction, which is in part why a property interest was recognized?
So I'd like to answer that question in two parts. One with respect to GOM and one with the transaction. With the transaction, that transaction was not subject to ISRA. The site was no longer an industrial site.
Sorry, so I want to just make sure I understand that. So had the waiver been rescinded in 2010, the transaction still would not be subject to ISRA?
Correct.
Ah, okay.
And so DeNovo and 760 Urban Renewal are not ISRA liable parties.
Can you say that one more? Can you explain why? When did ISRA cease to apply to the property?
So I don't want to say ISRA doesn't apply to the property because okay. The remediation ongoing is an ISRA remediation. There's obligations there. What I will say is that in 2007, the industrial operations ceased. Clarios's industrial obligations ceased. And that was what was subject to the waiver. And now the site is no longer an industrial operation. They have a property on which industrial operations are not being conducted. It is not an industrial property. When they transferred that property in 2011, they transferred property. They didn't transfer industrial property. It is formerly industrial property, but by the eyes of the law, that was not an ISRA transaction.
And that's because they ceased operations in 2007.
Correct.
Okay.
So when DeNovo purchased that property, they became obligated to remediate by virtue of that remediation agreement, but not under ISRA.
Are you relying on the town of Castle Rock?
I'm sorry?
Are you relying on the town of Castle Rock, that decision that the appellate division cited? Are you relying on that case?
In part, Your Honor.
In what way?
So in Town Castle Rock, I believe that they said that there was no benefit where the benefit was not ongoing and could not continuously be relied upon. And that's the same fact here. The benefit of not having to remediate that's been implied has never been something that they could rely on in an ongoing way. That Clarios could rely on in an ongoing way.
Where in the statute, can we understand that all that matters is whether it's an industrial property. And once operations cease, then it's no longer an industrial property. And so anything that happens after that doesn't implicate ISRA, even though there's, you know, separate contractual agreements.
I would have to further brief on that, but I believe that the definition of an industrial site is in the definitions of the Industrial Site Recovery Act. So in the definitions itself, it defines what an industrial site is, an industrial establishment is.
Okay. So I just want to clarify. So I think I understand what you're arguing. So your position that obtaining a RIP waiver, there's no benefit, because even if a party obtains a RIP waiver, they should not anticipate or expect that their obligation to remediate is even suspended. It's that
remediation is ongoing.
Ongoing, but
you can get this RIP waiver to do your transaction by virtue of the ongoing remediation.
But it's not necessarily.
You're always going to be called to task to remediate if that remediation goes out of compliance.
Right. So from your perspective, from the DEP's perspective, there is no ongoing benefit. So the only benefit obtained from the RIP waiver is at the moment someone either sells the property or ceases operations. That's the only benefit that's conferred. The benefit of not having to remediate for maybe 15 years in the DEP's eyes is not actually a benefit.
It's an indirect benefit.
An indirect benefit
of the remediation ongoing. And just to speak to your Honor's question with respect to GUM, I think the nuance has gotten lost. And again, why this transaction is not, you know, threatened by ISRA, because it was not an ISRA transaction. In GUM, the rescission was effectively an administrative order. So in GUM, when the department rescinded their underground storage tank waiver, the department said that the responsible parties would need to establish an RFS and remediate the site and conduct remediation. They gave affirmative obligations. And the GUM court looked at that rescission as it were an order and referred to it several times as an administrative order. So
I'm gonna curtail your argument on GUM because it has no precedential value under our rules.
Okay. Sorry.
You've used the word transaction several times. I want to make sure I understand. You're using it to refer not only to the 2011 sale, but you're also referring to the 2007 cessation of operations as a transaction. And that's what the waiver was useful for in this context, just the cessation of operations.
The cessation of operations.
Okay. On the timing issue. The way I hear your argument is that the benefit is extinguished at the very second they get the benefit. So if you're saying that the benefit is extinguished in 07, when they get the benefit, that feels a little hard for me to grasp. Well, is there ever a benefit?
So the benefit is extinguished when the transaction occurs. If they don't 11. Have the RIP waiver.
Transaction's 11. So is there a benefit from 07 to 11 here?
No, you're referring to the word transaction as a cessation of operations,
cessation.
Right?
Yes, I'm okay. Sorry, the cessation. I'll
the
start
very
to be more
thing that
specific,
leads them to get the waiver is the very thing that extinguishes a benefit that has existed for a millisecond in time?
For the cessation, in this instance, for a cessation. So that cessation, without that RIP waiver and without a remediation funding source in place or remediation certification or remediation action work plan, that is in violation of ISRA. So you have to do, an industrial site operator or owner has to do certain things when it wants to cease operations. It's got to establish RFS. Come into an agreement with the department, come into an agreement with a third party, or do some remediation where remediation is ongoing. You can cease operations without having to do those things in alignment with ISRA, so long as you have that waiver. It is not an excuse from having to remediate. The fact that the remediation is ongoing keeps you from having to remediate. The fact that the remediation is ongoing says you can transfer property without having to remediate the property for all intents and purposes during the cessation And once that cessation occurs, you've now had a valid ISRA transfer. So the benefit that Clarios received in this is that they could cease operations without also having to establish RFS. They could cease operations without also having to start remediating where remediation is already occurring. The waiver is really just to prevent redundancy.
So when did that benefit start and when did it end in this case?
It's for the limited cessation.
When, tell me, time-wise, when did the benefit start and when did it end?
When they ceased operations. So 2007, if you're looking for years, I think they requested the waiver in February. They received the waiver approval in March. They ceased operations a little bit longer after that in the same year. And once they ceased operations and wound up their business, the benefit extinguished.
The benefit was from March of 07 to when they ceased operations. Was the time of the benefit?
Yeah.
You've told us that the rescission of the RIP waiver is essentially notice. Is that fair?
Say that one more time. I'm sorry.
The rescission in 2022 of the RIP waiver was effectively notice
to the
players. Is that notice can be given in any number of ways, and there are multiple examples in this record. Is that how DEP gives notice for the rescission of a RIP waiver that's 15 years old? Is that the ordinary practice?
There's not a lot of practice with rescission of the RIP waiver. And mostly what the department will do is rescind the waiver and leave it to the parties to decide who's going to remediate. And that has worked out relatively well in practice.
So that is the course. Take the time element away for a moment.
Yeah, okay.
That's how notice is given with the not be on notice. You may have obligations. Here's a document. Here's an email. Here's a letter. It's the rescission of a RIP waiver that serves as notice. And that's DEP's practice.
There will be further notice once the administrative order is issued as well.
I accept that. But I'm asking about the preliminary step that you've told us is effectively nothing more than notice. Is that how DEP proceeds in the ordinary course?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there a process in place, or was there a process in place for rescinding RIP waivers back in 2022? Because the email that Mr. Prather mentioned, the individual from DEP states that they were in the process of working on a notice of intent to revoke. This process is new. Seems to indicate either no one's done it before, or I'm not sure what to make of that. It's an email, but do you know whether DEP had a process internally for rescinding RIP waivers?
So, Your Honor, in the last 10 years, the department has rescinded 6 RIP waivers. So it is a process that the department continues to develop.
Can you address the argument on the other side that the rescission occurred as a result of what was happening in the federal case?
The rescission occurred. So, and I don't want to continue to speak to the federal record, but it is in our record and you do have those documents. It is our understanding that DeNova, 760 Urban Renewal was in dialogue with the department over the course of several years, from 2016 to 2019, when it would submit documents and particularly the cost estimate that comes every year, and then the refund of the remediation funding source. And around 2019, they indicated to the department that they were having difficulty funding the remediation funding source.
Sorry, can you just say one more time, who were they in consultation with?
760 was in consultation with the department because they were under obligation to remediate the site due to the remediation agreement.
You can go on, sorry.
So when 760 was conferring with the department asking for more time, that there was this federal litigation, they were trying to get money from this insurance policy to fund the RFS. The department doesn't have any opinion either way about where the money comes from or how they get in there. They just want to get the site remediated. So when 760 Urban Renewal came back and said, you know, at this time, we think we need to start the process. The court has said, and specifically Judge Wolfson said, that until the department takes some action, and that action did not necessarily mean it would be rescission of the RIP waiver. It could have been an enforcement action. It could have been a complaint filed against Clarios. There's several actions the department could take. So assuming that because Judge Wolfson said the department needs to take some action is kind of nebulous, creates a couple of different ideas of how the department could enforce. But coming back to us and saying, 760, coming back to us and saying, we can't fund the RFS. We want to continue the remediation. Clarios has the money in this insurance policy and we're trying to go after it. Can you give us more time? Can you give us more time? And now we have we've run out of time and we've run out of money and we've run out of options and the department chose to enforce.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add, counsel?
Not at this time.
Thank you. Mr. Kettler.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Michael Kettler, and I'm appearing on behalf of the intervener and respondent in this case, 760 New Brunswick Urban Renewal Limited Liability Company. I do want to take a minute to correct the record a little bit about a couple of things that were just discussed about the communications, various communications with DEP. I want to make sure it's understood that when there were communications with DEP before 2019 about the remediation funding source, those communications were with DeNovo, not 760 New Brunswick. It was DeNovo and only DeNovo that has the responsibility to establish and fund the remediation funding source. There were communications with 760 New Brunswick later, which were some of the emails that Mr. Prather has referenced and that referred to the decision of Judge Wilson and the federal litigation. So it's a little confusing with all these different parties. Just want to make sure that that's understood. So we heard just now counsel for DEP ably argue that Clarios did not have a protected property interest in retaining its remediation progress waiver. Urban Renewal agrees that the appellate division correctly affirmed DEP's hearing denial on that basis. However, I want to take some time to discuss an alternate basis for affirming DEP's hearing denial. And that is that there were no materially disputed facts requiring an adjudicatory hearing in the OAL in this case. As we've been discussing, there's two steps to the procedural due process analysis. First, whether the state's action interferes with a property interest. The appellate division's opinion here addressed only that step because it found that Clarios lacked a property interest in the remediation and progress waiver under the Roth test. The second step of the analysis is whether the procedures the government provides are constitutionally sufficient. And with respect to that second question, what process is due? This court held in Bally Manufacturing versus the Casino Control Commission that, quote, due process never requires a trial on non-factual issues. Trial procedure is not required on issues of law, policy, or discretion, unquote. Several reported appellate division decisions that we cited in our briefs also hold that due process does not require an adjudicatory hearing unless there are contested material issues of fact. And notable among those decisions is In Re Cadgene Family Partnership, which upheld DEP's rescission of an ISRA letter of non-applicability and held that DEP did not need to hold an adjudicatory hearing in that case, quote, because the critical facts were undisputed. Here, Clarios's hearing request stated that it intended to dispute whether DeNovo, quote, is unable to contribute funds to the remediation funding source, unquote. And they wanted to dispute the sufficiency of, quote, any finding regarding DeNovo's financial ability to fund the remediation funding source. You can see that on page 12 of Clarios's appellate division appendix in their hearing request. But whether DeNovo had the ability to pay for the remediation was not material. DEP could rescind the remediation and progress waiver as long as DeNovo, in fact, had missed the required remediation timeframes and not posted the required remediation funding source. And there's no dispute that those were the facts. This court held in In Re Trantino that agencies have inherent authority to reconsider their prior determinations unless a statute restricts that authority. And here, ISRA places no restrictions on DEP's ability to rescind a remediation and progress waiver when the situation changes. And in fact, DEP's regulations and the waiver approval itself put recipients on notice that the department may still enforce ISRA against them in the future, notwithstanding their receipt of the waiver. There's no doubt here that the requirements for obtaining a remediation and progress waiver under the statute no longer are satisfied. The industrial establishment is no longer in the process of a remediation pursuant to ISRA, and a remediation funding source for the cost of remediation is no longer in place. Holding an adjudicatory hearing would not have and could not have changed those facts. And there is a forum to litigate its claim that DeNovo should be paying for the remediation. In the ongoing federal litigation among DeNovo, Urban Renewal, Clarios, and Clarios's insurer, Navigators, Clarios has asserted a counterclaim for indemnification against DeNovo for these costs. And you can see their claim in at page 138 of Urban Renewal's appendix in the appellate division. So an OAL hearing between Clarios and DEP is just not an appropriate forum to litigate Clarios's claim that DeNovo should be remediating the site. Now I'd be happy to answer any questions the court may have about our briefs and our arguments.
Just want to underscore a point that I think I heard you make, sure. And that is, assume the trust fund still had funds in it, mm-hmm. but deadlines were missed and the remediation was not ongoing. The waiver could be rescinded. It's either or?
Yes, either or. That each of those are requirements to obtain and I think keep a remediation in progress waiver.
If, as do you agree, I'm sorry, with the DEP that the only transaction relevant to the waiver in this case was the 2007 cessation of operation. And after that, there was no longer an industrial establishment to which ISRA applied.
Yes.
So why did DeNovo have any obligations?
So DeNovo only
the property in 2011.
Yeah, DeNovo only has an obligation by virtue of its a contractual arrangement. So, you know, to get into a little more of the history, which is a bit tortured. DeNovo acquired the property from Clarios in 2011. At that time, Delphi was the party that was responsible for the first ISRA case, and Delphi was the party that sold the property to Clarios in 2006. In 2013, and this seems to be, you know, in connection with a bankruptcy liquidation proceeding that Delphi was undergoing, DeNovo entered into a remediation certification, an agreement in which DeNovo assumed the responsibility for Delphi's ISRA obligation. So DeNovo has obligations under ISRA, but only because of this private agreement, not because of it bought the property in 2011.
Okay.
Does O'Bannon have a role in this case?
Yeah, I think O'Bannon has a significant role. I mean, O'Bannon is, and then I want to get into, I think now, some of the, you know, the first question, whether there's a property interest. I think O'Bannon controls whether Clarios has a property interest here. Because under Roth, a party can only have property interest in a government-conferred benefit if it has a legitimate claim of entitlement. If the party only has a unilateral expectation that it can keep that benefit, there's no property interest. And that's the issue at the heart of this case. The issue is whether the recipient of a government benefit has a property interest, this legitimate claim of entitlement, to keep that benefit, where the underlying law, here ISRA and its regulations, allows the government to take away that benefit as a result of the actions of a third party that the recipient can't control. And that gets to the point that was discussed earlier, that Clarios and parties like Clarios are in a way kind of at the mercy of the Delphi's of the world, the first party that's responsible for the remediation.
So the benefit continues beyond the cessation.
Excuse me.
The benefit continues beyond the cessation.
I would agree that there is some benefit to Clarios beyond the cessation. I think the appellate division was correct when it held that Clarios only had a unilateral expectation of retaining the RIP waiver. I should say remediation and progress waiver. It's hard to say RIP waiver. But that it didn't have to go so far as to hold that, you know, Clarios had nothing, you know, after 2011 or 2007. It had something, but the something that it had was really merely a unilateral expectation. And that's where O'Bannon and those kind of cases come in.
So you're saying they didn't have a legitimate claim of entitlement.
Correct.
Your use of the word benefit, unclear what that means.
I'm using the word.
Like you said, they did have a benefit.
Yes, I'm using the word benefit to refer to, you know, any, like a permit or anything conferred by the government. Some benefits are a legitimate claim of entitlement and are property interests under Roth. Other benefits, you only have a unilateral expectation to keep it. Those don't confer a property interest. The RIP waiver is in the second category.
So you disagree with the DEP then? Because the DEP is saying that the benefit was only the cessation of operations that happened in 2007. Once operations cease, there's nothing.
We don't think the court has to go that far to uphold the appellate division and the DEP. And we think that the appellate division was correct when it talked about Clarios having only a unilateral expectation. Whether or not Clarios retained any benefit in 2007, in 2011, 2015, the unilateral expectation we consider is really the key concept here. And that's where O'Bannon comes into play. I mean, the court has gone over the facts of O'Bannon a little bit in the discussion earlier this morning, but I'll give it a little bit more. You know, the federal government terminated the right of the nursing home to receive payments under Medicaid. And the Supreme Court held that the residents of the home, whose care was paid for by Medicaid, did not have any property interest, and so didn't have a due process right to a hearing when their home's, you know, Medicaid eligibility was terminated. Federal law gave those Medicaid recipients the right to choose to receive care at any qualified nursing facility that they chose, but it didn't give them the right to keep staying at a facility that had been deemed unqualified because of the actions of the people running the nursing home. And we think that Clarios is like the nursing home in that case. The residents, they're not like the nursing home. They're like the people living there. Clarios is suffering adverse consequences because the government has revoked a benefit that it previously provided. But just because it has adverse consequences, that alone doesn't give Clarios a right to a hearing.
Now, so can I ask you a question on a related topic? So in looking at what Clarios is concerned about, right? If you look at the May 12, 2022 letter, that Clarios has had no opportunity to contest the accuracy or propriety of the estimate of remaining remediation costs. Now, pursuant to the rescission, Clarios would be on the hook for those remediation costs, right?
Correct.
So would it,
if, well, when DEP takes further action.
Right? And so if Clarios is on the hook for those costs, wouldn't it be appropriate that Clarios be given an opportunity to speak to the very costs that they're being on the hook for?
I would argue that that's not really a materially disputed fact because the remediation funding source functionally has zero money in it. So whatever the future costs are, I don't think Clarios would dispute that some work is needed to be done and there's not enough to cover it.
So if the future costs were $1,000 or if the future costs were $5 million, you'd say that doesn't really make a difference because both of them are above zero.
In this case, yes.
You're not saying, sorry, that it wouldn't make a difference whether Clarios was obligated to pay $5 million versus $1,000. You're just saying there would be a hearing before Clarios was obligated to pay anything. And so it only has no bearing on whether the waiver is rescinded. It doesn't have no bearing on the future order that would be preceded by a hearing.
I think that's correct. And I'd like to discuss a little bit. I won't discuss gum because we're not supposed to talk about that.
Clarios, that's my fault. Take the complete blame.
Clarios also referred to, well, another unreported case, but I'll talk about it anyway. Morgan Stanley versus DEP.
You're going to talk about it briefly, is that?
I'm going to talk about it briefly. I'm going to talk about it very briefly.
Yes.
Urban Renewal argues that it doesn't really have any bearing here. That case wasn't about whether Morgan Stanley, in this case, you know, the responsible party, had a property interest. It wasn't about due process. You know, there the appellate division held that DEP's rescission of the no further action letter was, it was reversed because DEP didn't include enough facts in the rescission.
Just to be consistent, we don't need to spend time on precedential opinions.
All right, I'll leave it alone. If I can, one little thing.
Yeah.
The procedure that the DEP followed in Morgan Stanley was to send Morgan Stanley a letter saying your no further action letter is rescinded. The court never questioned whether that procedure was constitutionally appropriate. It's the same procedure that they followed here for rescission of the RIP waiver.
Can I ask one more question about any potential disagreement with DEP? The DEP seemed to say that the site was no longer an industrial establishment after the cessation in 2007. Mm-hmm. However, you argue in your brief that the statute is silent as to what happens if the industrial establishment is no longer in the process of remediation pursuant to 13:1K-11.5. And so does that mean that you believe that the site is still an industrial establishment, or at least was when the remediation was no longer actively happening as of, that was 2019 or 2021, whenever it exactly was?
Sure. I know we're really dancing on the head of a pin here, and I don't want to put words in counsel for DEP's mouth, but I think what she was trying to say is that after the industrial establishment ceases operations, future transactions like the sale of the property do not trigger the obligations of ISRA, but there is still an industrial establishment, I guess, a legacy of the industrial establishment that has to be remediated. So the lead and all of the contamination that's in the ground from the industrial establishment,
but that doesn't run to future owners. The only reason that you have to do that is because you signed this certification in 2013.
The only reason De Novo has to do it is because they signed the certification. Urban Renewal has no obligations under ISRA.
Is there anything you'd like to add, counsel?
Sure. I want to address just one thing that counsel for Clerio said about notice. There was no notice to them before DEP acted. I would observe that if indeed the appellate division is correct, that Clarius didn't have a protected property interest under the due process clause, no notice is required. I mean, you can look at, for example, the Third Circuit's opinion in Tundo states that pretty clearly, Tundo versus County of Passaic. Notwithstanding that, we would argue that Clarius, in fact, did have notice here that the remediation and progress waiver could be rescinded. That's because Clarios was conducting ex parte communications with DEP in January 2021, exchanging emails, as a lot of these parties had been doing with DEP, as you can see from the record. And one of DEP's responses to one of Clarios' emails said, part of the requirement for granting a remediation and progress waiver is that remediation funding source is established for the existing ongoing case. If the 2006 case fails to maintain the remediation funding source, then the remediation and progress waiver may no longer be considered in effect, and Clarios would also be obligated to post remediation funding source and or remediate the site pursuant to ISRA.
I think their point was they didn't want just notice. They wanted an opportunity to be heard. So an email telling them you may have a problem down the road doesn't really go to the argument that they're advancing, if I understood it.
I think that's probably a fair reading, but I would argue it's a fair reading that they had some notice. You know, notice doesn't have to be formal. It doesn't have to be a letter. It could be telling you that something's going
to
happen.
Did you give them an opportunity to be heard?
They had over a year between DEP. They've had plenty of opportunity to be heard with us in a number of different forums.
DEP give them an opportunity to be heard.
They didn't give a formal adjudicatory hearing, but there was.
You're saying they could have submitted whatever they wanted.
They could have submitted exactly.
And they were submitted whatever that all they wanted was to be able to submit things.
Correct. And there was a long period of time, over a year, between when DEP told them, you know, you might have a problem here, and when DEP acted a little more formally with the waiver rescission.
If they had an actual property interest, would this have been adequate?
Yes.
This potential exchange of information would have served the role of an adjudicated hearing.
Well, we would argue that
with decision-making authority.
If they had just because they have a property interest doesn't mean that an adjudicatory hearing is required in all cases. Other kinds of procedures and other kinds of notice can satisfy due process. And our argument here is that, you know, under these facts, because there's really no meaningful factual dispute, the particular process of an adjudicatory hearing is not necessary. And that's why DEP was correct to deny that request.
I'm just suggesting we not make too much out of an email dated January 21 of 2021.
Understood. So just to sum up the argument here, we believe the appellate division correctly decided that Clarios merely had a unilateral expectation to keep its remediation progress waiver when the first ISRA case, undisputedly, was not in progress. Therefore, it lacked a property interest under the first prong of the Roth test. And in addition, Clarios received all the process it was due in any event, was not entitled to an adjudicatory hearing in the OAL because it just did not raise a material factual dispute requiring such a hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kevin. Mr. Prather, brief rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just two points I'd like to underscore. Picking up first with Mr. Kettler's remarks regarding the exchange between Clarios' counsel and the department. That in itself, I think, encapsulates the mutual understanding that the remediation and progress waiver was effective at the time that communication occurred. The department was suggesting that whatever benefit that remediation waiver provided could be rescinded or removed at a later time if those specific things that were listed actually occurred. That is totally inconsistent with the argument the department's made now that the cessation of operations alone effectively terminated whatever benefit was provided by that remediation and progress waiver. Additionally, counsel for Urban Renewal suggests that sufficient progress was was provided because there was no disputed material facts. But that's a post hoc rationalization for not providing process. There was no process to make the determination that there were no material disputed facts. The submission that Clarios provided identified facts that were in dispute. And beyond that, Clarios highlighted that it had no facts because it had no visibility into the underlying determination that the department made before it rescinded the remediation and progress waiver.
But I think the point there that the department's trying to make is the only determination is remediation happening? Is remediation not happening? You can go to the site, you could see remediation happening, remediation not happening. That's it.
Correct. And Clarios disagrees with that because that remediation and progress waiver provided a benefit that entitled it to due process such that that determination that the department made may be the ultimate conclusion, but before drawing that conclusion, it must be based on some other factual determination that it provided notice to Clarios for and allowed Clarios an opportunity to respond.
Can you say that one more time? So you're saying they cannot just make the decision based on whether the remediation is in progress, or you're saying they can, but first they have to consider various other things?
The first part, Your Honor, and that's illustrated even further by what actually occurred here. The other counsel described that the history is somewhat tortured, and so I'm going to try to avoid overly complicating this, but de novo was the ISRA responsible party by virtue of being assigned those responsibilities by Delphi, who entered into a bankruptcy, and the ISRA statute itself does not allow a party that is subject to ISRA to have those claims under ISRA or responsibility discharged in bankruptcy. So Delphi would still be sitting with those obligations irrespective of that bankruptcy, if it had not assigned those obligations to de novo. De novo was engaging with the department because it was the ISRA responsible party. Clarios became an ISRA responsible party when it ceased its operations, but then it transferred the party to another ISRA responsible party that had already entered into an agreement to perform the remediation. What has occurred is essentially that after going through all of the required process, Clarios subsequently, without notice, opportunity to be heard, was deprived of that same benefit, even though the ISRA responsible party, from the record that we have available, had not engaged in any action to suggest that it was not able to perform the requirements as an ISRA responsible party.
You suggested earlier that not having enough funding was what you would have disputed at a hearing. And we heard on the other side of the aisle that it's an either-or proposition, that if the remediation is not taking place, whether the funding's there or not, isn't sufficient to defeat any obligations that ISRA may have. Do you stand that both need to be problematic, that you would have been entitled to a hearing simply as to the availability of funding, even if there was no remediation taking place?
Yes, and that relates, what the department describes relates to its overall goal of ensuring that the property is remediated. What Clarios is referring to is the benefit that it received in having its ISRA obligations suspended when it received that remediation and progress waiver. So that either or of whether the property is being remediated only really informs the question of, is the remediation taking place and is it going to be completed? It doesn't inform what is it that Clarios is required to do at this point in light of receiving that remediation in progress waiver. And as it pertains to that ongoing benefit, and this is my last point, Your Honors, the regulations that the department has for issuing that remediation in progress waiver highlight why there's an ongoing benefit. When there's an application for remediation in progress waiver, there's only one of two outcomes that the regulation provides for. Either the department grants that request, and then there is no obligation, the party may then close the site with no further obligation under ISRA, or it denies the request and the party must immediately take part in an ISRA remediation. If the first occurs and now you don't have, or excuse me, you have a remediation in progress waiver, it necessarily follows that the expectation can't be that you immediately have the obligation to perform an ISRA remediation. It's not how the regulation is formulated. It's not how the statute has addressed the deferral of obligations under the ISRA statute. And it's not how Clarios and the department engaged with one another after that remediation in progress waiver was received.
Other questions, any?
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. And thank you to all counsel for the very fine arguments. We're going to take the matter under advisement.